This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamoto, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today I have with me
Arnie Evans.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Arnie, you've been involved in broadcasting for quite some time.
Yes, I actually arrived in New Zealand with Operation Deep Freeze, and when I liked it so much, I said, I'll do an extra 6 months in the Navy if you let me out here.
And is this from the States?
Or? Yes. So in 1969, I started work at the NZBC in Christchurch. Mm-hmm. And I finally finished up my relationship with broadcasting in about 1990, when mm-hmm. I became a house husband instead.
Yep. Okay.
and a part-time communications teacher.
So and you moved to the Manawatu in
77. I'd been working in Wellington in the regional radio newsroom there, and I've taken extended leave, just sort of burnt out with the promise that there was a job there when I came back. And when I was ready to come back 6 months later, they said, well, we don't have a job here, but we need somebody up in Palmerston North. The chap in charge, chief reporter up there in the newsrooms, had a heart attack. Can you fill in? And it turned out the guy wasn't able to come back, and so I ended up here permanently. Did 2.5 years at Radio 2ZA in its last days as the only station in town, sort of thing.
Yeah.
2ZA, incidentally, in those days, was the most profitable radio station in New Zealand.
Okay.
We made more than 100% profit. We were the only show in town.
So it was regional radio broadcasting quite different then compared to now?
Yeah, well, we considered ourselves in news to cover everything from Thai Happy to Danaverk to Bulls and down to Levin. Mm-hmm. That was our brief when I first arrived here. After a year and a half or so, we got a new structure and had a new chap who was in charge of almost everything on the radio station. And he decreed that we got rid of Danaverk and everything else. We just did Palmerston North City, which I fought tooth and nail.
So how many staff were involved?
We had, in the newsroom, we had 4 full-time reporters, plus we had Catherine Shirey as our current affairs officer. Graham Bates was the rurals officer, and Phil Stevens was sports officer. So we had 7 people doing talks on 2ZA compared to less than 1 person full-time running the whole station nowadays. There were 30-some people on the staff altogether.
Okay, and that was normal for coverage in New Zealand as a whole?
Richer. We had a bigger technical staff than most stations did because we were right in the middle of the country, and everything fed through here. Went through the North Island.
Yeah.
We were the kind of, just like the railways with the core here once upon a time.
Yeah,
we were the same way that way.
Okay. But now there's a lot more sort of independent stations, aren't there? So
yeah. Basically what happens nowadays is almost the entire program is fed from a computer, normally in Auckland, to every, and that happens for all of these. They all have their own computers for the different companies. But what the music that you're listening here to on your local radio station, and somebody at the same time is listening to it everywhere else around the country, you know.
Yeah.
And they have little bits and the ads, of course, that are local, and that's it. So it's really a skeleton now.
Yeah.
What it was. And of course, there's no local news reported now, really, to speak of.
Yeah, yeah.
So we kind of lost that.
Okay. So what was it like when you first started here? You moved to Palmerston North in 77.
Yes, it was, as I said, we had this whole crew. We did, I think, something like a dozen stories a day we generated from Palmerston North.
So that's about 2 stories each per day.
Yeah.
How long would it take to do a story?
Well, finding them is the hard part. The thing that slowed us down more than anything else was finding the stories, and So the four reporters we had each had our own beat. And I instituted a thing of each reporter went out to one, like we had one reporter went to Tehachapi one day a week. The next week, somebody went to Dannevirke. So once a month, we spent a whole day in these places. But the news gathering is the thing that, that took a lot of time. I can remember that when 2XS was arriving and making their bid to be here, that they said they were going to do X number of stories very proudly, and I went back and looked, and we'd done sort of 2X for the last couple of years. So, yeah, it's that really finding the news that's the hard part. And radio generated most of the news for TV as well. TV, basically, as you know, talk about when we get to television, lived off radio. It was designed that way when they split them up, when they separated the NZBC.
So you go into the office and say, oh, I need my two stories today. Or is it planned a week ahead?
The afternoon, we did the morning's news. And you got in the morning at about 6 o'clock and you started madly phoning the police, the fire, ambulance, train running, as it was called, to make sure there hadn't been any derailments and on and on. And by 7 o'clock, you had your first five-item bulletin together. At 7:30, you tried to do a different lot of stories.
So there's no sort of pre-planning, knowing that this will be coming up as an issue in a week or something?
A lot of that was my job. I had the book there, and the reporters put into it any ideas they had coming up, anything they knew about and so forth, and I assigned reporters to various things and so forth, and tried to find any gaps that I could in between. So I didn't do nearly as much reporting as the others did. I was busy doing this sort of making sure there was grist to the mill.
Yeah.
That was more or less the chief reporter's job.
So how well informed were reporters about the issues? Is it just like a normal individual going up and saying, hey, what's going on? Explain it to me. Or
I can remember somebody saying to me once, you seem to know something about everything on Earth. And I said, yes, but I only know half a page. That was it. You became an instant expert. You just had to skim it off the top. But, of course, being trained as a journalist, there are an awful lot of skills there that help you with that.
So is it like, I know with written journalism, you write your story with your main bits and then you expect it to be cut from the bottom. With recording, is there something similar?
Most news stories never get to the point where they have to be cut. You know, 3-4 sentences is the entire story.
Yes.
You basically write the head. I've worked in all three media, and my take on it is that you really have to be somebody who can organize things to be a newspaper reporter. A radio reporter has to be very quick fire. And a TV reporter actually has to be a director of a team, of camera crew and so forth and all that. So they're all slightly different skills. But the radio one, the stories are so short that while you had the top of a newspaper story was all really. And you condensed, you tried to get a lot more into that than they would in their first four sentences is all you had.
Now, one thing we see with television, a lot of the story, there's the image or personality of the reporter, that's a step down for radio and a further step down for journalism, is it?
Are you talking about the way things have
changed? The reporter's personality comes through a lot on TV. The story perhaps a bit more in radio, and it's far more the written
stuff.
I think
the newspapers are the least personal, and radio still has some personality involved because people read things from your voice and so forth. I can remember, for example, sitting down in a crowded pub once, and these two young ladies ended up sitting beside us, which is very flattering, and one of them recognized my voice. And she said, you're Arne Evans. And I said, yeah. And she said, I thought you'd be much larger. So there is some personality that comes across on the radio, but more, of course, when you can see the person and so forth. There's just an awful lot more information in something we can see than there is either in the very codified print version of what we can see, or using your ears to hear something.
You think there's more in... my impression is that there's more factual content in radio news than television.
More facts, but more information overall, you know, just because our eyes pick up so many things. For example, you're watching the impeachment hearings that have been going on in America and so forth. Oh, yeah. And you look at this guy in the back, and he looks so soulful, and you think, who is he? And on and on and on. Now, that's not factual information that contributes at all, but you get an awful lot of information, an awful lot of just data, and a lot of it's emotional and so forth.
Yeah.
I think TV does appeal more to the emotions than either of the two.
Does it mean there's more scope for distortion as well?
Yes, yeah, definitely. Okay. There's more scope for, I don't know, I think.
Yeah.
You know,
well, they talk about shots of demonstrations where it's all narrow angle, and if you pan back, you find there's 20 people standing.
Yes. You just think of how much prettier our politicians have become.
Yes,
with
yes.
TV, because they have to, you know, because it's not about whether people think they trust them, it's whether they feel like they trust them.
To go back to the 1970s, was there much training given to staff?
Oh, yes. My wife and I both did a postgraduate year-long course at Canterbury University. There was another
a journalism course, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. And there was another one at Auckland AUT. And Wellington had a Polytech, Wellington Polytech had a year-long course as well. So by the 1970s, most journalists were either doing sort of polytechnic course on the job sort of thing, or had already been through one of these courses. Most of the journalists were actually professionally trained by then. It wasn't true of our allied thing that most journalists went into once all the jobs collapsed of PR. PR full-time training came around in the 80s.
I was going to ask that, because now there's a big move. People get journalism training, 1 or 2 years experience, and then move to better paid PR jobs.
Yeah. And there are just very few jobs left in journalism now. It's really kind of crunching down, and PR is growing, of course.
Yeah, because one concern now is that so much of the news is actually manufactured, pushing an agenda of the through the PR industry, and that's all a new development, is it?
Well, I think the consciousness of it is certainly new, but there were an awful lot of unwritten rules about gatekeeping and so forth. We you know, one of the standard things, you could write a story about anytime anybody built a public building, it was news. And it really doesn't matter, tinker's damn, to most people that they're going to a new supermarket rather than the old one. It might matter for a little bit, but it, you know, there were all these mainstays like that. In fact, radio and television news actually originated as a means of propagating government propaganda, government information. They were set up, you know, the first few years that it was set up to disseminate information from the government to the public. And that's how the NZBC got started in New Zealand. So there's always been a slant on information. I mean, you can't help it. I mean, just try to think objectively about anything yourself, you find you can't. I mean, I always said with politics that most people are not wedded to a party. They have one party they will never vote for. It's the way it actually works.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So that I think we're much more conscious now of the bias. But along with that, too, we feel much less guilty when we do it. And that's the terrible thing about it. Why do people think, for example, that running a country is that it should be done by choosing up sides and fighting each other? Mm. You know, this is a crazy way to actually run a family or a country, I think. But it seems to be that we've pretty much accepted that that's the way politics works now.
Yeah. Is there perhaps also more understanding of the nature of rhetoric and framing and so on? So people are more skilled at the manipulation, and maybe, I don't know if people are more susceptible to it.
There certainly is, I think. You know, if you look, for example, at education of communication areas now, people come out of school much more aware of what you can do. The trouble is, I'm not sure the general populace is keeping up. So I think there may be a kind of gap there between the manipulators and the manipulated.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, that it may be becoming easier to manipulate people than it used to be.
So what would a day be like? You go into work.
Okay. With radio, if you're on the early shift, you went in and you went through this rush of getting out the morning thing, because almost all your radio listening audience is the morning audience.
So and you start when?
You'd start an hour before the first bulletin, so probably 6 o'clock in the morning. Mm. By 9 o'clock, you're exhausted and ready
for
breakfast.
So the first bulletin is written between 6 and 7, is it?
Yeah. Well, most of the stuff would have been written the night before, but you'd compile it, put it together, and decide which to use, and then what to use for the next half hour, and what to do for the next, and so forth and all. So it's a shuffling thing. Yeah. One person would be doing this.
So in each station there'd be sort of a head of news who decides on the priorities. And
well, probably on the early shift, it'll be one of your reporters doing it most of the time.
Okay.
The head of news usually worked on a day shift because he had so much of the other organizational stuff to do, of the finding stories and that kind of thing. So of the four reporters we had, all of us could do early shifts and so forth.
Okay.
And we finished. You know, you had one on the early shift and three on the daytime.
Okay.
Well, actually two, because you had to have one person on the weekend, and they just did a day shift on the weekend because of truncated bulletins then.
So you would have ordered the items for the news. So what criteria would you use for that?
Well, a lot of it was there's a saying, a thing called the Hey Martha syndrome, which explains a lot of what you pick for your first one. Your best story is the one that if a guy knows these five stories, when he comes home and in the door, he'll say, "Hey, Martha, guess what I heard today?" You know.
So you don't use the line, "If it bleeds, it leads." Then.
Yeah, not then we didn't. No, I can remember, for example, in Christchurch, on a TV bulletin once, where I tried to put on a picture of there'd been a fatal crash out of the racing circuit, and I tried to put a black and white still picture of the car flying through the air on air, and the editor said, "That can't go on air."
Okay.
This was back in the late 60s.
Yeah.
So, no, we hadn't got there yet. I think that, and I remember too, Bill Ralston doing a thing about a train crash. This was back in the 80s. And they very carefully edited it so that no shot showed any blood. Hmm. Or so making an agreement about a Skyhawk crash at Oaxaca that we would let the Air Force look through the film before we put it on air.
Hmm.
So until that came along in the 90s and so forth, the sensationalism.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. In the late 80s. A lot of things changed with Rogernomics. That was one.
Okay, so you'd start off.
That was radio. Tell you about TV was different. TV lived off radio. So I would, in the morning, turn on the radio and listen to every radio bulletin I could pick up from Wong and Nui, the two in Palmerston North, and then I would phone through to Wellington and say to the news editor, "Here's what we've got locally," and he'd decide out of that what he wanted me to do, or he might have something that he had previously decided and send me out. And then it was a different kind of rush, basically because the production time for television takes so long. It took us we were limited to 10 minutes worth of film was all we were allowed to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And it took an hour and a half to get that developed in the 80s when we were using film. And then it had to be edited, and then you had to make a voice report to go over it and on, it had to be put into the bulletin and so forth. So basically, I had to be in Wellington by 2 o'clock every afternoon, and it was a two-hour drive then. So I had until lunchtime to get to wherever it was I was going to go and film my item along with my camera crew and so forth. And then down to Wellington, and while it was being developed, I'd go up there and write my script and so forth, and then we'd cut the film and change the script as we had to, and then I'd record it and on, all this lockstep.
So there's a lot of further editing with TV compared to radio.
A heck of a lot, yeah. So that my typical day would start, you know, at about 6:30 in the morning, and I'd be back home at 9 o'clock at night. Consequently, I didn't work 5 days a week. I eventually got to the point where I said to them, I don't want overtime. I just need the rest. Well, I'll tell you when I'm at 40 hours, and unless it's an emergency, I'm not available. Okay. They weren't very pleased, but they took it because they didn't have much choice, really.
So for most people working in TV, then there'd be similar hours.
Mine was different. Mine was an odd one. There were only about three or four people in the country who were out in the regions. Okay. And we had to do this thing where we were everything. If you were in Wellington, you had an awful lot more people helping you. You might even have a director with you when you went out, for example, who did all the planning and so forth, and on and on. And you didn't have to spend 2 hours driving here and 2 hours driving there and so forth. So it was a very different sort of job.
But you'd go with a team of, what, three or four of you, or just two, a cameraman?
Actually, the camera crews were interesting. There were four of them that I used. And they were all husband and wife teams, with the wife doing the sound. She carried the heavy gear while the husband had the camera on his shoulder. Didn't weigh nearly as much as the batteries. For Palmerston North, there was a chap named Maury Shaler and his wife Shirley, who lived out at Rongatea. I always called Maury the unofficial mayor of Rongatea because he was the volunteer fire chief and ran a shop that sold just about everything to everybody out there and so forth. Maury had been around a long time. When they first set up television news, they looked around the country for people who were experienced cameramen, and there weren't many, and gave them an official card that they could wave at people when they went out to do a story. And I saw Maury's card once, and it was card number 3. Yeah. So he was a real doyen. He was a solid cameraman, you know, but not a great technical expert. Well, expert he was, but you know, not creative in some of the others I had. But one of the bravest people I've ever seen. I remember one story where a chap named Richard Cassells was running Te Manawa, and in these days the government was giving people subsidies to employ university students over the summer. And he got the bright idea of hiring a postgraduate zoology student and a university student who was an experienced caver, and taking the team, or sending the team over to Hawke's Bay to where all these limestone caves are to look for moa bones. They found some moa bones.
Oh, wow.
So Maury and I, and Cheryl didn't go on that one. Maury's son, who was a fireman, was off for the day, so he went. And we went over, and when we got there, there was this hole about 50 centimeters in diameter.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, now this goes down about 3 meters. It does a kind of S-trap at the end. So we'll lower you down on this rope. Make sure you're facing that direction so that you can bend forward to get around the S-trap, because your back isn't going to bend far enough to go the other way. So we went down. Talk about claustrophobia. But anyhow, we got down there and we crawled through water with, you know, mud smearing on our backs and everything. And we finally got into this little hole. And there were the moa bones. And we did this interview. We, about halfway through it, the sun...
So you went in this hole in the ground to do an interview?
Yeah.
The sun, of course, and you had all the lights.
We had our little lights on our helmets and cameras and a little handheld sun gun, we called it, to light up the moa bones. Yeah. About halfway through, the sound tech got claustrophobic and we had to send him out. But Maury and I finished it up and then we went back through. And when we got back to going up through the hole and everything, Maury took off his shirt and he said, it was kind of tight squeeze. I want to get rid of everything I can. Got back up to the surface, got into the car. He always drove. And about halfway back, he said, I've got some really sore ribs. I went through the wrong way, through that thing they called the S-trap. And 3 days later, discovered he'd cracked four ribs. But he didn't. He carried through and did the whole job first. That was what he was like. So he was worth his weight in gold.
And then you broadcast it, and people thought you'd faked the whole thing and done it in the studio.
I don't know. No, I think they knew. Yeah. I'll tell you, the great fake was from the guy who was my cameraman from Whanganui, Brian Lurkey. Brian and Ann were a great couple. Brian was a very talented reporter. He was the chap who did the turkeys from Gumboots. If you've heard of the turkeys in Gumboots story, that was 1968, long before I was there. But what Brian told me is that Brian liked to have what he called a repast, a little drink after work and so forth. And he was having a drink with a friend who worked for Power Rubber and sold Gumboots, and another chap who was a turkey farmer.
Yeah.
And the turkey farmer was complaining about a disease called blackleg, I think, which the turkeys get when their feet get wet. And between them, after a drink or two, they worked out this scheme and went off and shot it. So that was the origin of the turkeys and Gumboots. Brian was, as I said, brilliant. He was a bit timid, though. I can remember I couldn't get Maury for a local job out at Manfield. There was an institution called Mother's Day, where the Mother's Motorcycle Club hired the thing. And put on races. Anybody who wanted to race their bike could come.
Okay.
You paid $5 for the entry fee. The only rule was no Italian bikes. It had to be American or English or Kiwi.
Okay.
Well, I got Brian over to do this. And as we arrived, I met him in the car park. And I walked over the car and he said, "There are an awful lot of scary looking people here, Arnie." And I said, "It's Mother's Day." And he said, "Mother's?" And I said, "Yeah, it's the Mother's Motorcycle Club." And it took me 5 minutes to get him to get out of the car, but we got through it all right. So that was okay. Probably my most talented cameraman was Richard Williams from Hawke's Bay. Although Richard and I never really hit it off never actually had the rapport, I don't think, but you didn't need to. By himself, he was just fantastic.
Yeah.
A story I can remember with him is the sea elephant. When there was this sea elephant had appeared in a Hawke's Bay Creek, and we drove way out through the Wallpops to get it. On the way, we came a feral turkey ran across the road with a bunch of little tiny turkeys following her, and Williams jumped out, grabbed a turkey, and took it home and said, "This is going to be Christmas dinner." He learned to hate the turkey, as it turned out, because he sat on his television aerial and then wrecked his reception. Anyhow, we got to the sea elephant, and the sea elephant just sat there, so I was made to get him to chase me up and down.
The sea elephant, is that like an elephant seal?
Elephant seal, that's what I mean. Yeah. Yes, elephant seal. Yeah. Yes, sorry. So I had to make him chase me up and down the creek so he could get some film of this thing in action. So that was a thrill. Yeah. It wasn't quite as exciting, though, as during the Springbok tour, my fourth camera crew, Sam and Susie Lowe, were a lovely couple in there. Early 60s, I would imagine, over in Taranaki. That was my first experience. I covered four of the Springbok Tour matches, and that was the first of them. It was the one right after Hamilton, when they'd shut down the field and everything. We'd had a rumor that the Springboks were going to come down by Air Force Hercules and land out at Bell Block Airport. So Sam and Susie and I were out there waiting for them. As well, there was the Bell Block Rugby Club, who had a big banner saying "Welcome Box" sort of thing, and about half a dozen protesters with their signs and everything.
Yeah.
We all stood around for about 45 minutes. It became obvious that the rumor was incorrect, and I thought, "Well, I've got to have a little bit of film to say they didn't come," over it. So I said, "Sam, shoot some film of the banners for us." He walked over and started filming the Bell Block thing. Protesters rushed over with their banners, and it was on. This huge fight broke out. I looked around, and one of the guys from the rugby club had somehow decided that if he could tear the headphones off Susie Lowe, who was this 60-year-old woman. All I saw was this he was very big chap attacking this poor lady. So I rushed over and grabbed him by the shirt and tripped. Mm. And he fell down, and I ended up sitting on top of him.
Yep.
And I looked up, and Sam was filming it. And I said, cut. Okay. And I stood up and I said, okay, everybody, stop. We're not filming. It's all over. And tootled off to Wellington thinking I'm in deep trouble because I didn't get the story. Yeah. I got down there and walked in the office to applause. And I said to one of the other reporters, what's this about? And he said, oh, it's about that guy you punched. I said, I didn't punch anybody. I tripped over someone. But apparently there was a radio reporter there who had reported on the lunchtime news that a television director had punched a rugby player. It's totally untrue.
Yeah. So they didn't use the film of you sitting?
They did not. No, luckily. But they did use some of the film of the other stuff.
This is part one of three. Listen next week for part two.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.